in these parts, we're reminded often of the struggles of early settlers in the matter of freedom versus slavery. Those struggles back in the 1850s were greatly important, but life in those days had another side, the struggle to survive and make a go of it out here on the prairies. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Fortunately, lots of accounts of that other side of life out here on the prairie still exist in the form of diaries and letters written by the people who settled this brand new Kansas Territory in the 1850s. Our guest today has read scores upon scores of those accounts and assembled them in a new book, Hope Amid Hardship, Pioneer Voices from Kansas Territory. Later in the program, we'll talk with two folks about what's probably the area's newest historical display. But first, let's meet Linda S. Johnston, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Linda will be with us in a second. Linda lives in Virginia now, but in the 1980s, she lived in Kansas, and with her son began exploring the Santa Fe Trail. That got her interested in Kansas history, and in all her other moves around the country, she has stayed interested. She spent some time with a collection of letters, and there's a big collection of them, at the Kansas State Historical Society in Topeka. She's also been at the Spencer Research Library in Lawrence at the University of Kansas, and her nearby library, the Library of Congress, the big one in Washington, D.C. The letters she's found are kind of interesting. For instance, let's go to this one from Sarah Robinson, who was the wife of the first governor of Kansas, Charles Robinson. On April 22, 1855, not long after the Robinsons had moved to this part of the world, she wrote back home, "The slit work for the stairway is set, and we are anticipating the time when we can get into the second story. How our friends in the East would pity us did they know just how we live. But I dare say there's not one in 100 of them who enjoys the half we do. Out here in Kansas," she continued, "we are deprived of no comforts, that is, of anything essential to our happiness. For coming to the real root of the matter, everyone will find that the externals have but little to do with a person's real enjoyment. We have fine, even spirits, and we feel it to live, to breathe in such a country is a joy, especially on a day like this." And when Linda joins us, I believe she's going to talk about the word that she found popping up most often in all these letters and diaries and accounts, and the word was hope. In fact, it's the first word of the title of her book, Hope Amid Hardship, Pioneer Voices from Kansas Territory by Linda S. Johnston. Let's continue a second and read from that letter of Sarah Robinson. On the same letter, I believe. "The roads for many days," she said, "have been full of wagons, white-covered migrant wagons." She's writing from Lawrence. "We cannot look out of the windows without seeing a number, either upon the road through the prairie east of us, which comes in from Kansas City, where most immigrants leave the boats and buy wagons and provisions for the journey, or going on the hill west, on their way to Topeka or other settlements above." 4 years later, you'll find the Topeka Tribune writing, "Immigration is pouring into our territory by hundreds and thousands. Those coming at this time will be bone and sinew of our country." And now we have Linda Johnston with us. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Monroe.
And you're joining us from Washington, D.C. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I mentioned already that you had toured archives ranging all the way from Topeka to Lawrence to Washington, D.C. Were there others you went through?
Yeah, that would pretty much cover it. I did a lot of research, of course, at the Historical Society in Topeka, Library of Congress, the Spencer Library at Kansas University, and also worked with Craig Freeman and Caleb Morse at the McGregor Herbarium at KU. They helped me on the native plants.
Great. And you got interested in all this by taking your two-year-old son out on the Santa Fe trail routes?
That's correct. At the Mahaffey Farmstead and Stagecoach stop in Olathe, I decided I wanted to be a docent there. And on my first tour, I waited for the guest to arrive, picked up a journal, began to read it, and I thought, I think I would like to know more about these folks who traveled west and left their family and friends behind.
Well, they were changing worlds, weren't they, from the civilized East, where houses, blocks were platted and houses and neighborhood rows and streets and horses and carriages, to come out here on what's like camping at the time, right?
Indeed. And it was a leap of faith, definitely, to leave the known behind, I guess, and go on this adventure to a place they knew nothing about. And that's another reason I was drawn to this project, is that I moved a great deal growing up. My father was in the military. My husband worked for an oil company. And so I know what it's like to leave family and friends behind and go someplace you know nothing about. And I felt that kinship with them immediately.
Now, when they came, a lot of these people were in the service of anti-slavery. And so they were, in one sense, political, but they were also looking to build new lives with farms and other things here.
That's correct, and established communities. And they, even though they were from very different places, many from New England, certainly, but others from England, Germany, and Iowa, and some from the South, they had in common that they were newcomers to that brand new area. And that helped them form a bond with each other right away.
Now, they were moving to what today we refer to as eastern Kansas, not necessarily near Kansas City, but out a little ways. Is that right?
Correct. They were in the Lawrence area, Manhattan, and Topeka. Those were really the first three areas to develop into towns. And also a bit south as well, Fort Scott, and a little bit north, Leavenworth.
I take it that they could, at that point, once the territory had been developed, they could actually buy land, measured off, surveyors, lawyers, all that to enforce it?
Correct. And many times that wasn't enforced, and several settlers would lose their land. But they would just move on. They kept at it, bless their hearts, and they were undaunted.
They had probably left wood frame or brick houses in the east. How did they live when they arrived out here?
When the first people arrived in Lawrence, the first group in the fall of 1854, they staked up tents in what we now know as Lawrence. And, in fact, the first church was actually a large tent. But right away, they did begin to build wood frame houses once they got a sawmill established, which was key in setting up a town, was to get the sawmill going.
The sawmill, so other people could have residence too.
Correct.
You mentioned the building of a church, the putting up of a tent that became a church. For a lot of them, as I understand it, were Congregationalists and pretty strong in their faith.
That's very true, and They organized churches right away, even though they might not have had a building, but that certainly was a priority to get the church organized and Sunday schools. And it served also as a way to socialize with other people and a way to share your concerns, much like today. In fact, that's a very important point of the book, is that the context is very different, certainly, from what we know today. But the human emotions are still the same. They were apprehensive. They were afraid sometimes. They were lonely. But they were joyful as well. And so, as I said, the context is much different. But those basic human emotions are still the same.
Some of these settlers' families began stores and shops and things, but a lot of them started farms. And yet, nevertheless, as you say, they lived in communities because of this human need to be next to one another.
That's correct. And even if the homes weren't very close, if they were miles apart, they still found ways to get together. And one instance was the surprise party, where one family would start out in their wagon. They would drive a few miles, pick up another family, and on down the road, until they finally decided, let's stop at this person's house. And so the surprise of the surprise party was actually on the host and hostess.
Yes, were things straight and was the floor dusted?
That's correct.
I can imagine that in those days, that anything riding up from the distance would have been considered a surprise until you identified it.
That's correct.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and we're talking about those people who settled our prairies more than a century and a half ago. Our guest is Linda S. Johnston, author of the book Hope Amid Hardship, Pioneer Voices from Kansas Territory. And if you'd like to call us and ask Linda a question about those earliest days in Kansas, give us a holler at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at kcur.org. And we already have a caller, Susie from Lawrence. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning.
What's your question?
My question is, Linda, have you had any contact with any of the descendants of people that were featured in your book?
Yes, Susie, that's a great question. I'm so glad that you asked that, because, yes, and that was certainly, as I did my research, I was hoping to locate some descendants. And I did that through a couple of ways. One was I searched the internet and actually found a relative of one of my favorite characters in the book, and that would be James Griffing, Reverend James Griffing, and found that his grandson had published some of his great-grandfather's letters. And I made a connection with James, or with Bill Griffing, right away, and it was wonderful to make that connection. And I also sent contact messages through Ancestry.com and located the great-grandson of John Deering, who, again, was one of my favorite people in my research. So, and it's wonderful to do that. And one other connection that I made was actually a person in my writing group, Women Writing the West, a national writers group. And her name, one of my friends' names, is Alice Trigo, who actually was the name of the wife of one of the men in my book. So that was wonderful. And actually, her husband is a descendant of Joseph Trigo. So that was very exciting.
So it's all about making connections.
It certainly is, Susie. It sure is.
Well, thank you very much for answering my question.
Well, thanks so much, Susie.
Yeah, thanks, Susie. Linda, in our area, the forecast is for temperatures in the high 90s, and so it has led to the section of your book called Summer. You've separated it into interesting chapters, sections, I guess, segments by the seasons. There was one Edward Fitch writing in Lawrence in 1855 that Thursday was a hot day, Friday was hotter, and Saturday was the hottest I've seen. The thermometer stood at 105 in the shade. We are sitting here in an air-conditioned studio, and I imagine you're air-conditioned there, too. Just enduring nature would have been tougher back then.
Oh, absolutely. And they do write a lot about that. Some diaries just gave brief descriptions of the weather where they would say it was cloudy or sunny and maybe the temperature. Quite often they actually gave the temperature. Many times it was in relation to the crops that they were growing. But indeed, they wrote about the hot weather as well as the winter weather. And at one point, John Deering, again, one of my favorites in the book, wrote about the winter weather. And he was sharing a house with two or three other gentlemen during the time that they were sleeping. The door blew open and the snow came in and started to drift actually inside the cabin. So that was a common occurrence. So that was definitely one of their biggest challenges, was to cope with the weather.
A lot of the letters contain descriptions of the flora, these flowers and those plants and those things. It must have been a different, not only climate, but also vegetative regime from what they were used to.
That's very true, Monroe. And as your listeners would probably guess, there are still some, or maybe they would be surprised to learn that there are still many native species that remain that the first citizens of Kansas described. And so in the process, that was something I definitely wanted to highlight, was the flora. And I worked with, as I said, the McGregor Herbarium at KU on that. And what we would do is we would read through the descriptions and try to match that up with a native species. And in many cases, they described it and gave a name to the species they would have recognized from New England. So that was really a game of wildflower jeopardy, if you will. But it was very interesting. And in the appendix, I do have an extensive list of the descriptions of their flowers and what we matched them up with.
Right. Here's, for instance, the very first one listed is the Golden Coreopsis, common name Golden Coreopsis. You give the scientific name and the person who wrote about it and where they
right.
lived, the Osawatomie area. That's great. You can call us and talk to Linda Johnston at 816-235-2888. 816-235-2888, or email us at kcur.org. And we have with us Ladine from Kansas City. Good morning, Ladine.
Good morning, Monroe.
And
my question is, Linda, in your research, what did you learn about the experiences of women and or women with widows, perhaps, who made this journey alone?
Yes, that's a great question, Ladine. Thank you for asking that. It was indeed very tough. And for many of them, they befriended other women, and actually there were instances where the women who came from New England or or the other locations would actually interact with the Native American women in the area, and at some point certainly helped each other. And they bonded with the other people, whether it was at church or through their children, and they were very supportive. And I think that was something else that really drew me to the project, is how both the women and the men coped with this incredible hardship. And that is where the word hope came from. And if I might, I could just read a short passage related to that.
Please do.
And this is from Charles Lyons, who came from New Haven, Connecticut, and to the territory. He was a Free State person, but he described in a letter to the New Haven Daily Palladium, "Hope is a powerful stimulus in all our migrations and trials in this world, and we feel its blessed influence here. We are content, though absent from those we dearly love, because we are still joined in heart and hope to meet again. And we rejoice, notwithstanding our deprivations, because we hope there is a good time coming, and we are willing to wait a little longer. It is more and more wonderful to us every succeeding day to notice how pioneers live, and yet how content they seem." And I think that's a very powerful message. So they maintained their hopefulness throughout these incredible challenges that they faced.
Yeah, their resilience is an interesting lesson for us today. Let's go now to Raymond in Kansas City. Good morning, Raymond.
Hey, good morning. I'm very interested in the in this discussion this morning. My great-great-grandfather settled in what is now St. Paul back in the early 1860s. And I was wondering if she had run across any correspondence or journal entries from people from that area. At that time, it was called Osage Mission.
Osage Mission. I can't say that I have,
Neosho County.
Oh, Neosho County, Missouri.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, Kansas.
Oh, Kansas. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
I have
south and west of St. Paul. South and west of Fort Scott. Excuse me.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, there. Yes, I'm just going to check my list here, because there were some settlers that in that area. In fact, I'm thinking that Miriam Colt, who described many of the flowers, I believe she and her group were camped at first on the Neosho River, and then I'm just going to check here, built an actual settlement there. They were a little concerned because there were a lot of mosquitoes. So that would be Elm Creek, which I believe is also off of the Neosho River. And, yes, they did settle. So they were a few miles west, maybe 20, I believe, or 25 miles west of Fort Scott. So she was the main one whose correspondence I did read, and she gave the best descriptions of the wildflowers.
Raymond, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Regina in Lee's Summit. Regina, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
You are indeed.
And
my question is, my mother's been reading a diary of a relative that arrived in eastern Kansas in the Manhattan area in the 1870s. And when she arrived, women met the girls at the train.
Oops. Sounds like we lost. Regina, are you there? Hello? We may have to come back to Regina. Linda, I have a question for you. These families that moved out here and that grew out here, these were big families with lots of kids, weren't they?
Yes, and many times they lost a few children, sadly, to disease. But, yeah, they were large families, and consequently, many of the descendants stayed in the area, which is wonderful to know, and I'm hoping to locate even more of those. But, in fact, as I mentioned, some of them did lose children, and one gentleman in particular, Joseph Savage, before he and his wife even got off the boat, they had lost a child. Ooh. And then in the next 1 to 2 years, his wife and 4 other children died. He had a daughter. He did end up remarrying, but he went on to be an important contributor to the community. He was an avid horticulturalist and a member of the First Kansas Band in Lawrence. So these are just ways that they continued to hang on. And as you said earlier, Monroe, we can certainly take a lesson from that. They were very resilient. That's not to say that there weren't those who suffered and left the territory. Some left immediately as soon as they got there and took a look around. But for the most part, these folks were able to deal with their hardship.
Let's go now to another caller. This is Riley in Overland Park. Good morning.
Morning. I was wondering if your guest would comment on the relationship between the settlers and the Native Americans that were here first.
Yes, I can address that. In a general sense, as I mentioned earlier, certainly there were interactions between the women and the Native Americans, but also one good example is on the 4th of July in 1855. That was a huge event, and for everyone concerned. And the organizers of the event invited the Native Americans, the local Native Americans, to join them in the festivities. And it was a grand day. And many times in Lawrence, and I believe Manhattan, although I know for Lawrence for certain, that the Native Americans would come into town and often play music for the other folks. So there was a lot of interaction, and one settler in her diary wrote about her husband being gone to find timber, and she was there in the cabin with the children, and a group of Native Americans came to her cabin and came in, and she did what her first instinct was, and that was to feed them. And they enjoyed their meal, evidently, because they left in a peaceful manner, and then once in a while would come back, and she would do the same thing. So there was interaction, and for the most part in the research that I did, that interaction was very friendly.
In fact, I remember...
Do you know what happened to the Native Americans? I mean, we know a lot about what the settlers did, and... They displaced a lot of people, and we know about the descendants of the settlers. Do we know anything about what happened to the Native Americans who were here first?
I did not take that. I didn't really go that route in my research. Although I did see some about that, and that would be really fascinating. And I certainly would like to research that as well. And that's one of the great things about doing this type of project is the incredible research and the places that it leads you. But that would be a very significant thread, and of course, in the settling of the territory. And
do you think they fared as well?
I really couldn't speak with that. Perhaps another scholar would be able to. But certainly, the people who lived around Lawrence, Native Americans who lived around, in many parts of the territory, they celebrated with the settlers, and they seemed to have pretty good interaction. That's what showed up in my own research.
Riley, thank you very much for your call this
morning. Thank you, Riley.
And in fact, in our next segment, we'll be talking with some people that may be able to talk a little bit about the departure of Native Americans and the dispersal of land around the Kansas City area. But Linda, while we've got you now, I'm going to add that Regina, whose call was interrupted earlier, added, I've been reading the diary of my relatives who arrived in the 1870s. And in that account, my relative says people were waiting when she arrived wanting domestic help. Do you find accounts like that? And what were the views on domestic help at that time?
Well, the folks who came in the early part of the territory, I didn't really find very much information about domestic help. I think there were some African Americans who came with folks out here, but in my research, I didn't really find very much about domestic help. But that was pretty early on in the territory. By 1870s, that perhaps was much different.
Linda, your book has at the beginning a map showing where the various families and the writers lived, and I of course immediately looked for the closest one to Kansas City and came up with George Hilt in southern Johnson County, Kansas territory. He's interesting because he was not of the anti-slavery persuasion. He was from William Quantrill's hometown.
Correct. And there certainly were people who, obviously, this was called Leading Kansas, and there were people on both sides. And And sometimes they got along. Sometimes they did not. There was obviously there were the border ruffians, and there was a lot of political upheaval. But there were people from all walks of life, certainly, and all persuasions, and they had come to Kansas for different reasons, not just the political aspects, but.
Yeah, it's. I guess the word would be it takes two to make a border war. On the question a second ago about domestic help, obviously in the Kansas Territory, the decision was going to be what were there slaves or free people, but were there just free domestic workers that may have been hired by these folks, or was it just life too raw at the time to even think about hiring help?
Right. I think these folks were pretty much on their own. That's the people that whose diaries and letters I read were certainly on their own. But as I say, by late 1860s, 1870s, it perhaps was quite different.
Okay. I'd like to thank our guest, Linda Johnston. Her new book, Hope Amid Hardship, Pioneer Voices from Kansas Territory, is out now. And she'll be in Kansas starting September 6th. For a series of events, including an appearance at the Kansas Book Festival and to teach a journaling class at an elementary school in Olathe. Linda, thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Oh, thank you so very much. And that middle school I'm going to be at is Santa Fe Trail Middle School in Olathe, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay. Now we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be speaking with Overland Park Historical Society's representatives. Central Standard Friday returns in just a moment.